take two on an interview tape with Geneva Wiskeman for the Voices of Lansing project by Joyce Moffat. It's being conducted at the Lansing Civic Players Fire Hall, and this is March the 6th, 1990, it's now about 12:10 in the morning. Geneva, let's go on. We had started to talk about you as the First Lady of the Capitol, that you, after the fire, provided two years of information there at the Capitol to anybody who came in and needed information. It must have been an exciting place there at the Capitol with the governor and the legislature.
It was a great laboratory for learning for me because we served the public. It was the only place we could contact the public at first after the fire. It was where people returned books and picked up books. And we also served state agencies and all the personnel of state government. It was, I was not the only person that worked there. There were other employees, but I think I worked there the longest. At first we were open full-time there. We had a teletype there that was connected to other teletype systems across the United States, and we were able to get books on interlibrary loan. That was the only way we had before we had OCLC and the modern technology that we have now. And we opened that teletype service up to state agencies, too. We moved prisoners by it. We communicated with all the DNR, what was then the Department of Conservation offices, and served all of state government through that teletype service. It was very unique and novel at that time. It was one of Mrs. Fian's ideas of how to continue to give service to the people of Michigan, even though we were in a state of disaster after the fire.
What year would that have been?
1951, 52. The fire was February 8th, 1951.
I love your stories of the fire, how you told how you had to move entire shelves of books that soggy from the water from the hoses.
Yeah. The water, it was such a cold day that the water literally froze in the air before it hit the building. And the building was covered with ice. It was when the fire hoses actually went away. And George and I were up there quite illegally about 5 days after the fire was out taking photographs. I loaned those photographs to the state library and they have disappeared, which is a disappointment because they were wonderful 35 millimeters photographs of the actual destruction that showed the one mezzanine floor falling through into the other with file cabinets in a pit and all, and pillars burned off because it was so hot that even the cement burned. It was a tragic thing. The Historical Commission records were, of course, the archives was there on steel shelving. And I remember it was the materials that were there at that time were still wet. It was all ashes, gray ash, but it was like they were sculpted out of ash. There were piles of books, books on shelves, piles of manuscripts, sculpture, all kinds of things. But they were just perfect in ash.
Oh my.
And as our bodies walked by them, the currents of air from our bodies would make the ashes fall down.
And be destroyed forever.
And it was gone forever. Even the 3x5 cards that told what archives were there were completely charred, like totally charred pieces of toast within the metal file cabinet, so we have no way of knowing what truly burned. But everything that was on that mezzanine floor was destroyed.
I saw just one picture, and I know what you're talking about.
It was a traumatic experience. Then we went back, when I went back to work, I wore a steel helmet and boots. We had squads, each staff person had their assignment. We were still a Red Cross emergency at that time. And I got a crew of five or six men from Manpower, and they were unusual men. You know, they drank hair tonic on the job and pinched your behind. And they were the men that helped me. And my job was to examine books for wetness and move them off of shelves and into boxes. And they had steel conveyor units set up so we could move the books out of the building. And after we got the wet stuff out, then we, of course, as the building began to dry and they turned on the heat, then everything molded. Nothing dirtier than books, so whole handprints would show up in yellow and red and green on the covers, and the book swelled. Sometimes you could have to use a crowbar to get them out of the shelving because the paper expanded. There was a situation in the basement where we had unique sets of federal documents where the books expanded so much that the wood shelving that they were in was actually splintered. It pushed the wood right out of its fastenings. It was a tragic area.
You were with the State Library for over 10 years, so you saw the change then,
mm-hmm.
from what it had been,
mm-hmm.
through what happened in the fire, and then on to its new home.
Eventually, I've lived long enough to see the new building built. Yeah, yes. I didn't think I was going to live long enough to see that. They were in temporary housing in the 300 block of Shiawassee Street, where the Lansing Community Arts and Science Building is now. It was a very old building. I remember one time I would work part-time there and part-time in the Capitol and carry books back and forth, in addition to having deliveries in the morning and the afternoon, so that we serve people on telephone demand. And that building was interesting. I remember it had a curly maple floor on the second floor, but it was so old that if they moved a file cabinet on the second floor, the people on the first floor got up and moved away from the area.
They weren't that confident that
no,
it was going to...
No, it was not built for its use. And of course they were there for a long time before they moved out to East Michigan Avenue, and from East Michigan they were able to move to the new building. Whole new world of library science and service now, but certainly years of struggle.
You've always played a key role in the community, there with the library system preserving history, but your roots are very deep in the community. There's streets named after your ancestors. You've been here that long.
Oh, my mother was a Howe, and in Clinton County we have Howe Road, which was named from William R., her grandfather.
And then your Keebler roots were the German.
Yes, they came, I'm sure, much later, 1854, but they moved from a farm in Ingham County, out here on Harrison Road, down to... Clinton County in Eagle Township and established a farm home there.
Mm-hmm. And you still remain in Clinton County with your farm, which is how
yeah.
old?
Yeah. We still own a small section of the original farm, but I live in Watertown now, which was a home where my husband had his residence when we married. So I still end up in Clinton County. But it's nice living in the capital region, because county lines disappear. I'm pleased about that, because that means you can work anywhere. You don't have to say you're from a particular county. You're from the capital region. I think that's much more important. I'm so delighted that in the mayor's State of the City address this year, he talked about a regional chamber council for the city, which means they would have representation from Bath to Witt, Eagle, and Watertown, and all the townships of Clinton County, which are so affected by what the mayor and city council in Lansing does. And that's the way the money comes down. It comes down regionally. I think that's a step in the right direction.
I think it is, too, because we need to have representation. We all feel the outcome of what happens in Lansing. So we should be represented in that outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You were president of the Historical Society of Lansing, but again, this wasn't just Lansing. It was the Greater Capital Area Historical Society.
Right. That society has used the boundaries of the Lansing Community College School District for their boundaries, if they had any. They never really had any boundaries, but we had representation from Ionia, Shiawassee, Clinton, Ingham, and Eaton. And it was Greater Lansing, and it was the parent of many small historical societies, Eaton Counties, Clinton Counties, Grand Ledge, Eaton Rapids, Mason. We were also the parent of the Michigan Genealogical Council, because that started as just an interest group, like a subcommittee in the Historical Society. But genealogists are more inner-directed than historical people. Historical people, you know, are born with their arms wide open, and because they grew with their own special interest, then they went off like the good child they were and became independent and followed their own challenges.
What were the goals of the Historical Society here in Lansing?
To preserve the history of Lansing and serve as an educator, I believe, and make it fun for people. We never intended to accumulate materials, because we had the state located here, the State Museum, as poor as it was at that time, and the university, Michigan State University's museum. There have been several others that flowered during the bicentennial era, and we have even more now than when the society was formed. And we had the public library that was accumulating books. We in no way wanted to be competitive. We wanted to send it to established collateral collections, and I still believe in that.
You managed to save the records of another organization, the Chamber of Commerce, and I've heard you talk about seeing the building being bulldozed, and you take over from there.
Well, the Chamber of Commerce had a red brick building. It was a classic piece of Lansing architecture, which was bulldozed to make it. It was right next to the old Pruden Auditorium, and when they took down the Pruden, they soon took down the Chamber of Commerce building, and many of the records were still in the building, and they sold off the woodwork. The woodwork in each room was different. There was a curly maple room, a cherry room, and so forth. And I know that Rollins Devens was able to acquire the bound volumes of the State Republican and some of the State Journal that were in there. And later, many years later, we were able to use that collection to fill in a gap in the microfilm file that's at the State Library, because we found it there in Rollins' basement. And the records were actually bulldozed under with the house. And one day a man who worked for the highway department called me up and offered to sell some materials. And he said, I asked him where he got them, and he said, well, I'm just picking them up from the new soil where they're putting in this new state building, which was then would be the Mason building. And sure enough, when you walked over there, you could see papers still sticking up from the surface, blowing in the wind. And so he went down at night and literally dug up records, papers, and I acquired by gift from him 16 feet of records of the Lansing Chamber of Commerce that included photographs and scrapbooks of clippings and some correspondence, which were really the records of the Lansing Businessmen's Association, the predecessor of the Chamber of Commerce. Lots of interesting material on the development of the Wolverine Way, the contributions of Mr. Pruden to the construction of the highway between Lansing and East Lansing, so that it would be cement rather than mud. And I thought it was a very valuable collection that he was interested in selling most of the material. I think he probably still has some of it that he sold for the letterheads and things of that kind. But we were able to acquire some of it, and we have a finding aid for that. It's usable. Sad that it's only a remnant, but it was indicative, I think, of the time of the business community's approach to history.
You mentioned the Wolverine Way. I've never heard that expression before. What does that refer to?
It was the development of the highways. They traveled, for instance, they went by an old US 16 from Detroit to Grand Rapids, which is the old military highway of territorial days. But to get that paved, they had a project called the Wolverine Way. And as they went through by farms, farmers would give money to the fund to get this made into a passable year-round cemented highway, a two-lane highway.
And we call that highway what now?
It's now old US 16.
I see. You said something else that I think is important too. You talked about you had a finding aid. Mm-hmm. In your job with the state, you were able to publish over 20, I believe, of these finding aids to different locations. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, when I went to the American University to learn something about archival administration, I saw these very usable finding aids that the federal government did, and I really patterned them to what we did in Michigan on those. And they were individual monograph publications with a brief history of the agency in respect to the records that were being described. And we had a series title, the dates they covered, and a unit number, a unit which could have been one picture, one reel, 1 foot, or 1 inch, or 1,000 feet, or 10,000 reels, and one paragraph, succinctly written, giving a brief description of the record, what it was, basic content and the arrangement, just as precise and thoroughly objective description, bringing no prejudice whatever to the language. We put those together and did them for the censuses, the military establishment records, and some of the social welfare records, the most often used tools. These were very cheap. We're still using them, and I think there's a place for them in the services to the public. Since then, when Martha Bigelow came, we were able to, as director, we were able to publish a guide to the state records, not local records, state records. But by then, I was at home taking care of my mother, and I didn't have the freedom to do that for her. But they used this whole file cabinet full of typewritten finding aids that I had done, unpublished, as well as the published ones to compile into this publication, which really is very usable. You have to make things available. It's no good on the shelf unless people are using it.
Right. You were very valuable again in editing and writing the foreword to Justin Kestenbaum's book, Out of the Wilderness.
Yes, I did that for Justin. Came at a time when I was recovering from surgery, and I didn't think I did very well with that. It wasn't, I worked hard on it, but I didn't think it was that good. But I remember Eugene Langer read it, and he called me up and said it was very good, and that made me feel better.
I agree with Eugene, right? then again, you came up as editor of Lansing Capital Campus and Cards. So you've been involved in publishing many times.
Well, I enjoyed doing that because I got to work with you and was really a historical advisor, I would think, more than an editor on that. I published, one of the things I did when my mother was sick was to, I had to be up a lot at night as well as daytime, and I took the names off of Clinton and Ingham and Livingston map, ownership map and compiled those and got those ready for publication. Not very creative, but it's been a usable thing because the map is rather scarce. Uh-huh. And the one in the state archives, each time you unroll it, more of the map flies away. The pieces fall off the backing. So with that, the publication, they were able to retire the original and not expose it to such hard use. So there is a place for that sort of thing, although it's not my favorite kind of work.
You were able to steer us into some really interesting directions to find places not only where women were instrumental in history, but instrumental in some exciting fields like flying. And you mm-hmm. maintain that contact with people like Babe Ruth in mm-hmm. the Women Aviators. I picture you.
Oh, I love to fly.
With your bright hair and red hair in those days.
Days like this, I have a hard time staying on the ground. Yeah, yeah.
The stories must be great that you've heard with Babe, too.
Oh, yes, yeah. There are a lot of great women storytellers.
Yeah.
And Babe's had an interesting career in aviation. We do have a tape recording of her in our Voices of Clintonia, which was an interesting project I worked on. We were able to get a CETA grant for Clinton County, and we acquired the only county government or any government-supported oral historian in the state of Michigan to this day. Before CETA went out, we hired a young lady who had experience in English from Michigan State. Of course, she was starving to death for that kind of credentials. You know, there was no place for her if you couldn't get a job teaching, and what else was she to do? And so we used her for our interviewer and transcriber. She got some of them transcribed. And we have a good cross-section of people interviewed in Clinton County about how they felt about their county and about their rural life as it changed into an urban, even a megalopolis community that we're going to have. And so I felt very happy about that because she moved from that right into a job at Michigan State University and went on. So it was a good example of what CETA was supposed to do.
Train people.
Train and expedite people into their most productive occupations.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned the Voices of Clintonia because that was the next thing I wanted to bring up. It was you and your role, and as I understand it, you're the person who is most instrumental in oral history in Michigan. You were president of the Michigan Oral History Council and started our Lansing Oral History Voices of Lansing Project.
Yes. I started that. Voices of Lansing actually grew out of one that we were talking about at the Ariola Museum. And we wanted to, I had thoughts of that even when I was president of the Ariola Museum, was to go out and get the unique story of people involved in the development of transportation productions in the greater Lansing area. And my problem with that, Joyce, was that I had an interview with Scott Radford, and the morning I was to interview him, he died.
Oh.
And to this day, I've never been able to go back to that project. I gave some workshops, and I think they were well received, and they were an interesting audience. But when people found out how much hard work it was and how much time it was going to take on, you know, a lot of the volunteers fall away. Uh-huh. But I'm sure that we will get back to that. But with the History Committee of the Chamber of Commerce, we were able to revitalize the idea, and including the library, the public library, under the capable direction of Joyce Thomas, we reactivated this and called it the Voices of Lansing.
What's the state doing by comparison? When you were president with the state, what's happening throughout the state in oral
history?
Michigan
does not have an oral historian.
No.
Does not have an oral history office as Kentucky, Tennessee, or T- Texas, for instance, many, many states have either state-supported or offices in higher education, like well, I think of Baylor University as one of the leading places in Texas. They have oral history centers that receive government funds, but that's not true in Michigan. In fact, the only official oral history office is a one-man show within the Department of History at Northern Michigan University in Marquette. Without Russ Nagnagy there, that's it. And that's why the Michigan Oral History Council was formed, was to fill this gap. We had a meeting at Michigan State University. Maury Crane was very much involved with that. And we heard people at the Kellogg Center throughout the session saying that they had these valuable, wonderful tapes, but no one was using them. Well, no one was using them because nobody knew they had them. Mm-hmm. And they weren't available, and it would be as a great service if we could match the researcher with the resource, and that's the prime reason for our beginning. We still do that with an inventory of tapes that are available and with transcripts and indexes and releases. And when we first began, we found that people were not getting those necessary releases, and sadly, we always have to start with that education in our workshops, that without the release,
it's useless.
It's a waste of your time.
You've always been my mentor in history. Teach me again. Teach me how these could be used. Use your vision to tell me where and how these could be marketed and utilized.
How many hours do you have to hear about all the uses? They're a great resource as a historical document because done properly, they are a historical document, no better than any other traditional source of history. They have to be corroborated and corroborated and corroborated. But they also are unique because they fill in gaps, it's true, but they also have all the spontaneity and the poetry of people, the sound of their voices, the regional dialects. The other day on PBS, I heard some people from the Eastern Seaboard, particularly in Vermont, who were complaining about all these new people that were moving in and how the sounds of their language was changing. And they resented this very much. These people don't even sound like us. Well, of course they don't. They're not from Vermont. That wonderful sound. So, all of those things show up in the tape that are very human things. And I think there's a lot of some people conduct oral history for fact, whatever that is, and other people conduct oral history for the humanistic aspects of what happens to people when they talk about their firsthand experiences with another person who also influences the interview, and then there's interview for therapy. It's very rewarding, very therapeutic sometimes to get your thoughts in order and talk about things. You hear people say things that they've never articulated before. Maybe you hadn't even known they thought about before.
I believe that. I believe that we're always a sounding board for each other.
So it's used a great deal for students in what is called journalistic, cultural journalism, using the community for class as a classroom, for great scholarly research of all kinds, and for therapy. Sometimes I think the interesting thing is that it's used for reasons far beyond those that are anticipated in the beginning. For instance, the records accumulated by the survivors of the Holocaust. One of the first groups to use those tapes was the United States Department of Justice, who came in searching for clues to Nazi war criminals. And that was a far cry from what was anticipated.
I could think of another as finding relations between the survivors, mm-hmm. helping them find people that they might have
other
lost
people.
There,
or right.
at least know of their
mm-hmm.
past.
But I have a friend who did interview a survivor of the Holocaust, and she said she could not transcribe it. She could not hear it twice. And she told the family this, and they said, oh, that's all right. We just want Papa to say it, and he can do it. He can throw away the tape if he wants to, and throw away the pain with it.
Good idea.
So there's lots of different uses.
Right. I can imagine. You've always collected books and collected maps. They're all so much part of your interests. And then you added those interests to your husband's interest mm-hmm. of collecting guns and printing presses. And
yeah.
You've got quite a collection now. Tell us about...
Well, I bought my first book, I think, was a Clinton County History from Ted Foster. Theodore George Foster was an amateur historian who had professional standards. And he collected, bought a lot of books, and I bought a lot of things from Ted. Through the years, and George bought things from him, and actually, we knew that family in segments. We now know their grandchildren, but we were friends of Ted's a long time, and then after Ted was gone, we got to know his wife, Margaret Pegg, very well. She was a great storyteller, and then we seemed to know each member of the family individually, which has been interesting. I've got a lot of things that relate to the Foster family, and eventually those will go back to the family.
This is the Fosters with Collins and Cleveland.
That was Walter Foster, who was a brother of Ted.
I see.
Yeah, and George collected Michigan-made guns and was very interested, avid reader, and so his interest in history and mine fell together, and he began to buy county histories and atlases to find the gun makers and where they were, and it just kind of went on from there, you know, buying history materials. We had a good time doing that through the years.
One of George's presses is currently at Michigan State University.
No, that wasn't our press. That was a press that was owned by the Gannett newspaper company that was in the public library. And it had been in a parade at the time of the centennial of Lansing, I am told. And at that time, the toggle, which made it an operative Washington-style hand press, was lost. And for a long time, it sat in the public library right by the elevator, and its main use was to prop up posters. And it was Lois and F. Downing who said, you know, it deserves better. And so Everett and George traveled around Michigan to find presses that were similar. And George, with his knowledge of tool and die, drew the specifications for the toggle. Well, he died before he could get it done. But now we have the toggle made, and we moved the with the Downing drive, constant drive, over institutional inertia. We have got it out to Michigan State, the toggle's in place, and I gave them lumber for the old maple 16-foot maple flooring pieces for the floor of the exhibit. That's going in right now, and their staff is slowly building a old print shop where this press will actually be a working press where they can do demonstrations.
Wonderful. Your collection of posters ended up on the front of Justin's book, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were really pleased that we were able to share with Justin for his publication on Lansing history a lot of ephemera and paper materials that had not been published before. It's nice to use fresh material as long as it's available.
I won't ask your age, but I'm curious.
Oh, I'm 63. I just had a birthday.
Right.
February 15th. I'm just so quiet and happy to have made it this far, Joyce.
You're kind of post-Valentine baby.
Yeah.
Just right after Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
What's your first memory of Lansing that you can remember?
What did the world look like to you when you can first remember Lansing?
Coming to Lansing, I didn't come to Lansing very often. We didn't shop here or anything that I remember. I remember coming to Lansing when my sister Betty was older than I, 10 years older than I, and we would occasionally come to town and shop. I have one of those dime store pictures of me with my hair all curled up in a little peach-colored dress. I always had a good time doing things with my sister. And because she was 10 years older than I, you know, she waited a long time for me to grow up to do things with her. Then I remember coming to Lansing at night and seeing the Capitol lighted up, back when it was covered with little small light bulbs, not floodlighted as it is today. It was very distinctive at that time because it was, the whole dome was strung with lights, and that was very impressive.
I remember one of the first stories I heard was about towers that were in the middle of the streets where the policemen stood, I believe, or fire towers. The house. Did you ever see those?
No, I never saw that.
That
I remember there were still railroad or streetcar tracks. There were no streetcars, but there were the tracks were still there in the brick pavement.
We have a picture of East Lansing where they gradually get cemented over and over through three decades.
Yes.
And finally the street becomes smooth.
Yeah.
And we tore the streets up and put bricks back again.
Yes, and in front of the Capitol, that's what we did. Yeah. That brick paving, there's a nice strip of that and the entrance to Grand Rapids. You can still see it. Sometimes it shows through where the macadam peels off. That brick is still there. It was a very durable form of pavement that was sponsored by the State Highway Department. Got some beautiful lantern slides of the construction and so forth in the state archives from the old Highway Department. But it was so expensive in manpower.
One of your special interests, too, is the Turner Dodge Mansion.
Yes, I remember giving tours to the Turner Dodge Mansion when it was a dirty, grubby hole. I always went home with a nasal infection because of the mold. But I remember standing on the back, what some people call the back, it's the riverside of the house, and with people standing in the rain all the way back to what is now the parking lot. That was not there at that time. In fact, when they made that parking lot, the people who bid on the job didn't know that a whole Lansing school had been dumped in there, and that it was full of huge pieces. We're talking 6x8 chunks of cement. And I talked to the bulldozer man one day, and I said, did you know this was in here? And he said, no, I would never bid on the job if I'd known. And I said, I'm sorry we didn't tell you. Because some of us knew that the city had dumped along that bank for years. And that the very area where the parking lot is now to the southeast of the main structure was a dump.
So you've seen the growth from that, then the Turner Dodge Mansion to... Yeah. What it is today.
So now people stand in line at family Christmas to come into a renovated house. We've just got a $70,000 grant from the legislature for a master plan for use of the house, which we think is a prime necessity. It will be directed, turned over to Parks and Recreation for that purpose.
How do you see it in the future? What will it be like?
Well, the city never decided what they really wanted to do with the house. We know it can't be a house museum because theirs are so extremely expensive and there are so many of them in the area. It deserves to be used as a small cultural center for the community. And I hope to see a reconstruction of the carriage house, which the city tore down. You have it built specifically for an educational center for the north, to serve particularly that north end of Lansing, where we would have perhaps even studios for artists to work and training centers and and have it take some of the pressure off the house, because some of the uses that we have in the, had in the house, just to keep it a viable thing to, for the city to support. They pay the heat bill and they replace the windows and keep the roof on, things of that kind. Take some of that out into the new training center. Like to, I think there's a great deal that can be done there.
We'll take a little break and come back. I want you to tell me about the 5 locations in the city you think are the best locations of all that any person who is interested in history should never miss.
Okay.